This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Kenya's Minister of Health has ordered two top hotels in Nairobi to shut down after they were linked to a cholera outbreak. The minister, Cleopa Mailu, said the hotels had supplied food to an event where cholera was reported.
That's Rael Ombora reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
Also, for the first time, more than half the people living with HIV/AIDS have access to life-saving treatment. And according to the World Food Program, millions of people around the world are going to bed on an empty stomach.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya's Election Commission will be allowed to proceed with the current contract to print presidential ballot papers. An appeals court has overturned a ruling by the High Court that the commission cancel the contract and restart the bidding process. The High Court had cited a lack of transparency in awarding the printing contract to a firm based in Dubai. However, AFP reports the five-judge appeals court squashed the ruling. It says the opposition coalition, led by presidential candidate Raila Odinga, failed to prove any links between the company and President Kenyatta. Odinga has accused the ruling party of planning to rig the elections. The vote is set for August 8th.
Kenya's Minister of Health has ordered two top hotels in Nairobi to shut down after they were linked to a cholera outbreak. The minister, Cleopa Maeuli, said the hotel had supplied food to an event where cholera was reported. Rael Ombor reports from Nairobi.
The order for Nairobi's San Valentia and Jacaranda hotels to shut down follows allegations cholera may have been transmitted through the hotel's catering services. This is after several delegates attending a trade expo catered by the hotels this week were hospitalized with symptoms of the waterborne disease. Two cabinet ministers attending the expo were also affected. The Ministry of Health said this week that 336 possible cases of cholera have been reported in Nairobi County since May and that three people have died. Nairobi's Governor Evans Kidero told journalists that this outbreak, unlike previous ones, has spread beyond poor areas.
It's not just been people who are in the informal settlements like Mathare, like Kibera, like Mukuru, but we notice even the people from higher income areas have also fallen.
Last month, around 50 visitors to an international medical conference held at Nairobi's lavish Western Hotel were reported to have fallen ill with symptoms associated with cholera. The Ministry of Health says the latest incident at the Trade Expo is being investigated and that the samples of food, water and sewage are being tested. It is said results from the tests are expected within a week. Meanwhile, Nairobi County Health Executive Dr. Bernard Muya said all restaurants in the area are being inspected.
We are mapping out all any eatery. And when I talk about eatery here, I'm even talking about any hotel, regardless of the category. Also validating the food handlers.
Minister of Health Mailu said Nairobi's water services will also be thoroughly inspected. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And this just in here in Washington, D.C., police say they do not suspect foul play in the disappearance of six Burundian teenagers. The teens had taken part in an international robotics competition. Police say two of the teens were reportedly seen crossing into Canada, but the whereabouts of the remaining four are not known. The students had been staying at a dormitory at Trinity Washington University. They were supposed to be under the close adult supervision and had been advised not to leave the dorm. However, wire services report the teens went missing Tuesday night and event organizers then called police.
For the first time, more than half the people living with HIV/AIDS have access to life-saving treatment. UNAID puts the figure at 19.5 million. It hopes to raise that number to 30 million by the year 2020. There's more good news. The number of AIDS-related deaths has fallen from nearly 2 million in 2005 to 1 million last year. The number of new HIV infections is declining, but the agency says not fast enough. New infection fell by 16% from 2010 to 1.8 million. However, not all regions are seeing a decline. UNAIDS reports alarming increases in new infections in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. All those between the ages of 15 and 24 are lagging in testing, treatment, and prevention. And only 43% of children with HIV have access to antiretroviral therapy, compared to 54% of adults. UNAIDS is also raising concern about growing resistance to HIV drugs. It says this is a threat that could undermine global progress in treating and preventing the disease. It says HIV drug resistance develops when people do not adhere to a prescribed treatment plan, often because they don't have consistent access to quality treatment and care.
The World Food Program warns millions of people around the world are going to bed on an empty stomach. That's because the cost of feeding them is skyrocketing due to conflict, instability, and other complex emergencies. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the WFP World Food Assistance 2017 report was released.
The World Food Program reports humanitarian needs and complex global emergencies are growing, as is the cost of feeding the hungry. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lusche says some 800 million people globally are going hungry. She says many are caught in conflict or natural disasters. Others, she says, are silently wasting away in the absence of media and the publicity needed to expose their plight.
We know how to end hunger. But all of our efforts are so often hampered, blocked, impeded because there's fighting going on. And that, to me, is like the big tragedy.
The WFP reports the cost of providing food aid has gone up by more than 140% from $2.2 billion in 2009 to $5.3 billion in 2015. Lucia says the amount of money needed for humanitarian programs this year is expected to climb to more than $9 billion.
If we had better access, WFP could save $1 billion each year. If there weren't any climate shocks, if there weren't political crises, if there weren't conflicts or economic shocks, we could save $2.2 billion each year. And if there were better food systems in each country, then we could save $440 million each year.
WFP reports two regions, Eastern and Central Africa and the Middle East and North Africa, account for 70% of the agency's expenditures. It says nearly one-third of its budget will go for humanitarian assistance to four countries struggling to stave off famine: Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan, and Yemen. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A European Union court has upheld a decision to freeze the assets of two companies accused of trafficking conflict diamonds and supporting armed groups in CAR. Reuters reports the court said that by continuing to purchase diamonds from collectors, the firms Badika and Karadiam provided support to armed groups in Central African Republic. Badika is a diamond trading company and Karadiam is its affiliate in Belgium. The EU froze their assets in 2015.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 14 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Here in Washington, D.C. police say they do not suspect foul play in the disappearance of six Burundian teenagers. For the first time, more than half the people living with HIV/AIDS have access to life-saving treatment. And the World Food Program warns millions of people around the world are going to bed on an empty stomach. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
A former Nigerian oil minister already linked to corruption and money laundering in Britain is facing more problems at home. AFP reports a Nigerian court has ordered the temporary forfeiture of $37.5 million in property belonging to Diazani Alison Madueke. That property includes an apartment complex in the Sheikh Banana Island in Lagos, home to the rich and famous. Prosecutors say she bought the complex with ill-gotten gains. Alison Madueke is currently on bail in London for a bribery charge stemming from investigations by the U.S. and Italy. She was oil minister under former President Goodluck Jonathan.
The head of Libya's UN-backed government has called for parliamentary and presidential elections in March 2018. Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj also called for a national ceasefire and the gradual merging of rival parliamentary bodies based in Tripoli and the East. Claudia Gazzini, senior Libya analyst at the International Crisis Group, says it's doubtful these initiatives would end the Libyan conflict. She spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
It would be very nice to think that an announcement for elections next March would solve the problems. Unfortunately, the issue here is that it's hard to see how Libya can organize elections by March 2018. The problem is who's supposed to draft the electoral law. Remember that Libya has parliament in the east that is internally fragmented. It has another advisory / legislative body in Tripoli. And neither of the two bodies actually can even reach a quorum with regards to their members. And so it's doubtful that they'll be able to pass an electoral law. Some say that a constitution has to pass before elections can be held. And in fact, that was the original roadmap that the international community and Libyan members of the dialogue committee in 2015 had agreed upon. There was supposed to be a Fayez Sarraj-led government for 2 years. At the end of these 2 years, meaning at the end of 2017, there was supposed to be a new constitution approved, which would then pave the way for elections. Now, Libya has no constitution yet, and there's no prospect of having a constitution passed and approved by the end of this year. And at the moment, there are little chances that the parliament will be able to pass an electoral law or that the various parties in Libya will agree on electoral law.
The prime minister of the Government of National Accord also called for a national ceasefire and the gradual merging of rival parliamentary bodies based in Tripoli and eastern Libya. Would General Haftar and his allies in the east agree?
One of the positions that Haftar and his allies in the east have taken over the past 2 years is fundamentally to not recognize the authority of Sarraj or of the presidential council. They consider this government in Tripoli as having been imposed by the international community. And their constituencies are really, you know, opposed to coming under the authority of Sarraj. So in principle, there is room for some form of understanding between pro-Haftar constituencies, mainly in the east, and those that follow the presidency council headed by Fayez Sarraj in the west. But I fear that the issue that is most problematic is whether this merging that Sarraj refers to would lead to a setup where Sarraj remains at the helm of the country. This, I fear, is something that Haftar and his constituency would not agree upon.
So with such serious obstacles, what could the international community do to put an end to the Libyan conflict?
You know, the Libyan conflict is a multifaceted conflict. It's, a conflict about over money. It is a conflict over ideology. And it is also a conflict that is fueled by the intervention of regional powers. So really, to have a final end of the conflict, we would have to address all three aspects of the conflict simultaneously. You know, stop this downfall, this collapse of the Libyan economy, which is making Libyans poorer, which is increasing smuggling, and which is therefore also increasing the interest groups, especially the militias that are linked to the smuggling routes. It would require simultaneously achieving some form of intellectual understanding between camps that are on opposite sides of the ideological divide. And the third issue, it would require limiting the interference and the support of regional actors to the various factions. Unfortunately, it's hard to see these three levels being enacted simultaneously. So at the very least, what the international community can do at this point in time is put all its efforts into stopping the economic crisis of the country, or at least helping Libyans stop the economic crisis, and fostering initial dialogues between camps that are on the opposite end of the ideological divide.
Claudia Gazzini is senior Libya analyst at the International Crisis Group. She spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shinawi.
In the Gambia, tensions are mounting as the new government refuses to issue a permit to supporters of the former Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh to celebrate the military coup which brought Jammeh to power. The celebrations have been scheduled for tomorrow, but President Barrow says treason will not be celebrated under his rule. Jammeh seized power in July of 1994 after toppling the democratically elected government. Pandari Mbai has the story.
It had been a tradition in the Gambia that every July 22nd, Yahya Jammeh and his supporters celebrated the military coup 22 years ago. They call it a military revolution which toppled the 30 years rule of former President Sir Daouda Kairaba Jawara. Jammeh and his family are on exile in Equatorial Guinea after losing last year's elections and being forced to step down by troops sent by neighboring countries. The new government of President Adama Barrow says it will not allow the commemoration this year. It says July 22nd represents a dark day in the Gambia when young army officials illegally overthrew a democratically elected government. Demba Ali Jao, Gambia's information minister, says given the atrocities committed by the former Jammeh government, there will be no celebration of the coup anniversary. There is growing discontent among Jammeh supporters. One of them is Jibril Fadia, a Gambian based in the U.S. state of Rhode Island.
We are not celebrating any event. We are not celebrating any atrocities that have committed, if there is any. We are not celebrating that. We are celebrating the foundation and the birth of our party, which is APRC, and we are entitled to it. It is a right. As long as we are not creating a violent, we are not making a violent, we are calling for violence. I don't see any reason, and we haven't done that.
Ibrahim Achongan is a former Gambian Deputy Inspector General of Police under President Jawara's government. Achongan was among the security chiefs jailed in 1994. He was held for 2 years before going to the United Kingdom, where he now works with the Britain Home Office. He was one of the many victims of torture under Jammeh.
It's a somber day that we need to reflect and remember the victims. We all know that it is a coup where a bunch of soldiers declared their oath and overthrew the democratically elected government. What has happened, and the 22 years of what has happened is well commended. You know, the deaths, the disappearance, the victims. So I think it should be a somber day of reflection so that we should never ever forget the victims, and it should never ever happen. Come on, we cannot celebrate a treasonable act.
Human rights groups such as Amnesty International have repeatedly condemned the celebrations of the military coup, saying Jammeh committed widespread abuses. Meanwhile, the leader of the opposition APRC party, Pabakari Tombong Jata, says there were numerous developmental programs initiated by the former Jammeh regime. Jata also accuses the new coalition government of being afraid of the APRC by refusing to allow the party permit to celebrate its anniversary. He called on the government to respect the fundamental rights and liberties of Gambians, irrespective of one's political affiliation. However, critics say the former ruler denied such rights to many citizens. For VOA Africa, this is Panderimbay reporting.
The head of the French armed forces has resigned after a clash with President Emmanuel Macron over budget cuts. As Henry Ridgewell reports, Macron's new government, trying to balance the books, faces pressure from the cost of military commitment both at home and overseas.
Following his resignation Wednesday, General Pierre de Villiers said in a statement that proposed budget cuts this year meant he was unable to guarantee the protection of France. It's the first big test of authority for President Macron, says analyst Sophia Besch of the Centre for European Reform.
But it also shows, and I'm sure that's his intention, that he's serious about making cuts, about bringing the French economy up to speed with the European targets.
Macron wants close to $1 billion shaved from the 2017 defence budget to address the annual deficit. But government spokesman Christophe Castaner said Wednesday that military spending would rise beginning in 2018 and beyond.
Dans ce cadre, le président de la République a réaffirmé son engagement sur la montée progressive du budget des armées jusqu'à atteindre 2% du PIB en 2025.
He said the President of the Republic affirmed his commitment to a progressive increase in the armed forces budget to 2% of GDP by 2025. The United States is pressuring NATO allies to meet that 2% target as quickly as possible, but France's military is already committed on several fronts. Around 7,500 troops are deployed on the streets of French cities following recent terror attacks. French forces are engaged in military strikes against Islamic State jihadists in Syria and Iraq, and they are also taking the lead in counter-terror operations in North Africa. A 4,000-strong French force is deployed across the Sahel region. Again, Sophia Besch.
France's military activism of the recent decades, has led to the military being overstretched, to capabilities being underfunded.
Macron's pick for the new military chief, General François Lecointre, led the EU mission in Mali, which the president chose as his first state visit after taking office.
We can't tell yet what these cuts will mean for specific military missions, but we know that France under Macron will remain committed to French commitments in Africa.
Macron has called on European allies to share the burden of counter-terrorism operations in Africa. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.